Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to our meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is Can Technology Drive Conservation and Create Healthy and Safe Environments? With Rhett Butler, founder and CEO of Manga Bay, Troper White, founder and CEO of Rainforest Connection, Crystal Davis, director of Global Forest Watch, and Virgil Zinnerland, director, Protected Seas, Chief Technology Office. Before we begin the program tonight, a few announcements. The first one is that we are videoed tonight, so there we will see our video person back in the back, and you'll know that we are videoing for the program tonight. A special welcome to our members and our friends and new members. If you have not yet become a member, we urge you to join us. Visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org and look on our website at www.commonwealthclub.org/listen for Commonwealth Club videos, radio schedules, online and streaming audio programs on 230 national radio networks. Look also for program archives, audio, and videotapes, and subscribe to our weekly free podcasts. Some gentle reminders for tonight. Our program is timed for 1 hour. Make sure that all cell phones, PDAs, and other noise-making devices are turned off. We will use audience cards tonight. You will find cards near you. I will pick them up for our speaker. And we will do those for our question and answer period. So if you're interested in asking a question, fill it out for us, look for me, give it to me, and I'll be giving it to Rhett. And that's how we will handle our audience questions. We will now begin our program for our radio audience and our video audience, and for you here in the audience. We welcome you very, very much, and we really are grateful for your coming tonight. This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is Can Technology Drive Conservation and Create Healthy and Safe Environments? It's my pleasure to introduce you to our distinguished panel. And introducing our panel will be Rhett Butler, founder and CEO of Manga Bay. Rhett?
Thank you very much for having us. It's an honor to be here. We've got a great panel here tonight. We've got Crystal Davis, who's the director of Global Forest Watch. We've got Topher White, who's the founder and CEO of Rainforest Connection. And we have Virgil Zetterland, who is the director of Protected Seas. So when it comes to environmental issues, it's easy to get caught up in some pretty depressing trends. We're losing something like 20 million acres of forest a year. The oceans are acidifying, and we're losing species by the day. But there are some reasons for optimism, and I feel like technology is one of those reasons. So technology is being used for a wide range of applications. We have indigenous people using cell phones to map and protect their territories. We have conservation biologists using drones from everything from counting orangutan nests to mapping coral reefs. We have activists who are tracking global commodity supply chains using cell phones, and the list goes on. And even journalists are using these technologies. So at Manga Bay, we have an initiative called Wild Tech, where we're investigating how conservationists can better leverage technology. So the folks that we have here today are broadly representative of some of the trends and spatial scales of these technologies, and so very excited to get started. So I'd like to start with Crystal Davis, who again is with Global Forest Watch. So can you tell us a little bit about Global Forest Watch and who your users are?
Sure. Thanks, Rhett. I'd like to start by framing a little bit of context about the problem that we set out to address when we created Global Forest Watch. Given that we all live in an age of real-time, on-demand information at our fingertips, most people are actually really surprised to find out that we know very little about what is happening in forests around the world. So consider that the Amazon rainforest alone is greater than half the size of the United States. It's facing significant pressure from commercial activities like logging, agriculture, and mining. And the people on the ground who are tasked with protecting these forests often have very limited resources at their disposal for monitoring and enforcement. We're typically looking at a very small number of people responsible for a very large area of forests, and they're typically just monitoring these forests by foot on the ground. So by the time they actually find out where deforestation is happening, it's usually far too late for them to take action. So we created Global Forest Watch with the hope of trying to overcome this information challenge by monitoring forests from space. Back in 2007, the U.S. government made a really big move to make satellite imagery from their Landsat and MODIS satellites freely available to the public. And this was a huge deal because before that, we were spending thousands of dollars just to buy a single satellite image. But even once we had access to all this great imagery, it would take one person many hours and often many days just to analyze a single scene looking at a very small patch of forest. So if we wanted to be able to do this across the entire world, I think all the forests would probably be gone by the time we even finished the job. So we started working with scientists at the University of Maryland who were developing a computer algorithm that could basically do this work for us very quickly and very efficiently. But then even to sort of make a long story short, once we developed the algorithm and felt that it was accurate enough, we had to figure out how do we actually run this thing at scale, because we needed to look at a fire hose of satellite data that was coming at us from these satellites on a weekly basis. So it was a massive computational challenge. And of course, when we think of big computational challenges, we think of Google. So we asked Google if they could help. And we started working with the Google Earth Engine team. And using their platform, we were able to run the algorithm. And we're now pumping out weekly, monthly, and annual updates about where deforestation is happening, literally everywhere in the world, zooming into an area the size of a baseball diamond. So once we had this data, the next challenge was figuring out how do we actually get this information into the hands of people who can act on it. So to do that, we built the Global Forest Watch online platform, which we like to think of as basically the Google Maps for forests. It's free to use. It's incredibly easy and intuitive to use, even though the underlying data and technology is actually quite complex. And we've been working with partners around the world to try to help them understand how this information can be used to support their forest conservation efforts. And since we launched the platform back in 2014, we've seen millions of people from literally every country in the world use the site. I used to like to make a joke that the only country that was not using Global Forest Watch was North Korea, but we have actually had one user from North Korea, and I'll leave it up to your imaginations of who that one user might be. But our users range from protected areas, managers, to Fortune 500 companies that have committed to eliminating deforestation in their supply chains, to indigenous communities, to advocacy organizations as big as WWF, but also grassroots organizations as well. And we've seen some really incredible results from these users who are taking this information and using it to identify and interdict forest crime around the world. So I think there's a lot of potential in this technology, and I actually think it's only really the tip of the iceberg. The algorithms are getting smarter, the satellite imagery is becoming more precise, and of course, more and more people around the world are getting connected, so they're able to access this technology and this information. At the same time, I think we also continue to confront on a daily basis the limits of technology and realize that even if you have perfect information and perfect technology, you still need humans to take an action that will be positive for forests. So I think even though as scientists we all tend to focus on the conservation science and the technology, we also don't need to remember the science of human behavior and what really drives decision making. And I think there's still a lot of challenges ahead for us, both in terms of continuing to develop the technology, making it accessible, but also making sure that it's used for good. So I'll just leave it at that to keep it quick so we have plenty of time for questions.
Thanks, Crystal. That was great. So Global Forest Watch is operating off satellite data primarily, but you're also getting data from the ground up. So Topher, you're really a ground up, you really have a ground up application. So I'd love to hear, have you talk a little bit about Rainforest Connection.
Yeah, sure. So Rainforest Connection is our startup, and it's based on this idea that it's really great to have eyes in the sky. You can't really match the transparency of satellite data and the ability you can see so much from above, and nothing's going to stop it in most cases. But there's still granularity of data and a sort of real-timeness of data that's necessary to have an on-the-ground element. And so that's really where we come from. And we operate off this premise that there's actually infrastructure out there in the field, even in these really remote places, that can have a big impact. So in our case, we use old, you know, basically cell phone networks that are already out there, particularly on the periphery of the forest. We take old, you know, cell phones, essentially, put them up in trees with solar panels and microphones. They listen to all the sounds, stream that up into the cloud over these pretty bad cell phone networks that are out there. We analyze it using more advanced techniques, which we can put in the cloud, and we can pick out chainsaws, logging trucks, individual species, gunshots, and then send real-time alerts to people on the ground who can show up in real time and stop it. And the idea behind this is that even though for now we have to be responsible for going out and putting it out there and training the partners, all the elements of that, except for the cloud-based element, which is pretty easy to scale, can really be built and implemented by people on the ground. And this idea that even these old indigenous tribes that have been out there, they're actually coming up on their second old smartphone. And if it can be as simple as them downloading an app and being able to monitor their areas in real time, that can be really helpful. As Crystal noted, you know, they're all obviously very under-resourced on the ground. The traditional ways of doing this are having people go out on foot and monitor these huge areas. I kind of feel like that's not really a good expectation in our day and age. And at the same time, there's so much you can learn about the forest by making sure that you're listening to it and paying attention to it when no one's there. So the fact that we can monitor this thing 24/7, the fact that we can use big data, modern techniques to pull all sorts of insights out of the forest makes it not just useful for conservation, but also for ecology, for biology, for studying these places as real ecosystems and turning ecology biology into a big data problem. And so that's where the AI sort of becomes a really important approach. But really, Rainforest Connection, the reason it's called that, is based on this idea that if you really want to help people in the field, because they're the ones who can have the biggest impact. You know, each ranger out there in the field protecting, say, just a few hundred hectares of forest, they can have more impact on stopping climate change than like 100 engineers at Tesla, potentially, just based on the fact that they're out there protecting these huge carbon sinks. So we have to build technology as Silicon Valley engineers to help them get their job done, because that's how actually we can have the biggest impact, I feel. And so the way in which we could do that isn't just with tools. Sometimes it's about connecting them to the people around the world, because these are the real heroes. And so sometimes this streaming data coming out of it, we have to find ways to get people interested in saving the rainforest, which sounds funny perhaps to people in this room, but I feel like the narrative around saving the rainforest hasn't really changed in 20 or 30 years. It's like how many football fields are destroyed per second, how much the rest of this stuff is happening. Whereas the rest of the world, our idea of what's important has changed to not what's big or potentially impactful, but to what's like real time and now, what's happening right now. So if anyone got an alert on their phone, like if they got an SMS on their phone, you'd be pretty hard-pressed not to check it. I don't blame you. I'm the same way. We all are. So if we can take what's happening in these really remote places and turn it into a real-time connection to people around the world, there's a chance of making them feel like it's not so abstract and really trying to garner their interest around it. And that interest in and of itself, it can have a really big effect on the morale and the effectiveness and honestly the longevity of these people out there protecting these areas. So sometimes knowing that what they're doing matters to the rest of us is as useful as money, as resources. So we're trying to make that possible. So we want to take this very simple idea, which is that we can use old infrastructure and old trash, like old cell phones, to stream live data from these remote places and use that to build applications to get everyone interested around the world in it, to empower people on the ground so they can make a big difference, and then also to empower scientists to learn new things, because the more we can learn about it, the more momentum we'll have in being able to save it. And I can talk about some of those applications as we go through the evening. But yeah, that's pretty much the idea.
Great. Thanks, Topher. So these first two technologies have really been looking at forests, but of course, most of the Earth is covered by oceans. And so, Virgil, you're involved with developing a suite of really interesting technologies for oceans. So can you tell us a little bit about your work?
Absolutely. And Protected Seas, as the name implies, our mission is developing technology for ocean conservation. And we have a lot of the same common challenges that we find on land, and like panels like this are really great to highlight that. To frame an ocean issue, a really current one this year is the North Atlantic right whale. situation in Canada. They've had 10 mortality events just in the previous 6 months, which, you know, anytime you talk about a whale, 10, you know, seems like a big number. But to really put that in context, this is out of a population of 500 individuals known to be remaining, or about the equivalent of the human populations of Canada, Chile, and Australia combined being lost in a single year. So, you know, as a technologist, we want to think about, well, how, you know, how can technology make an impact on saving right whales? And really the answer there is usually the initial question of any science. To be able to act to save, we first have to understand the basics. How many right whales are there? Where do they live? How do they use the habitat where they live, so that we can learn how to minimize our human impact on their mortality? So we're very fortunate to be able to participate in a program called Whale Alert, which is NOAA's official program for right whale ship strike reduction. It's also used here on the West Coast to reduce the risk to gray whales and blue whales to ship strikes. And so the purpose of that is to get an application basically on mobile phones, on the web. Anyone can submit whale sightings, basically broadening the real-time knowledge to whale managers of where these populations are so that they can design effective management. Which really brings us to the next part. As our understanding grows, then we're able to start to make marine protected areas, which is a major way that we protect endangered populations or habitats on the water. Marine protected areas are great. They'll cover, you know, some are small, some are large. One of the things we found in outreach on our other projects a couple years ago was boaters and fishermen knew in general about marine protected areas, but they didn't feel comfortable that they could really discover the specifics for their place, for where they boat. So we put together a team to map all the marine protected areas in the world. And not only just draw the boundaries, but make it interactive. Let someone go to our website at mpa.protectedseas.net, click anywhere along the coast, immediately see a list of all the restrictions. What can I do? What can't I do? All in one easy-to-use place. So take away that question mark of, you know, I want to be a good steward, but I just don't quite know how to do it. We're happy to be a partner with NOAA in that as well, pushing that information also back into government channels to inform better management over time. And so, again, we've gone from knowledge to establishing protections. Of course, the final piece is, unfortunately, there are people who don't want to do good, who don't care about the protections, and so we need ways to monitor and enforce what we've put in place. And so we've been developing a system called Marine Monitor. We're using off-the-shelf radar electronics to lower the price point, and then our own custom software that allows people to track boats in marine protected areas, see when they're there, how long they're there, be able to task law enforcement, whose resources are limited, to try and be at the best times and places to be effective.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-led
Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is, Can Technology Drive Conservation and Create Healthy and Safe Environments? With Rhett Butler, founder and CEO of Monga Bay, Topher White, founder and CEO Rainforest Connection, Crystal Davis, director of Global Forest Watch, and Virgil Zitterlin, director of Protected Seas and Chief Technology Officer. And so back to you, Rhett.
Thank you. Thanks, Virgil. So Topher and Crystal hinted at this a bit, but so sometimes you have a technology and it seems like you're looking for a problem to solve that technology, which is seems a little bit backwards. So when you are trying to solve a conservation problem with technology, there are often a lot of issues that need to be addressed first for that technology to actually work. So what are kind of the enabling conditions you need for these technologies to be successful?
Sure. I think the biggest challenges we bump up against with Global Forest Watch are governance issues. And it's really about having the political will to do something about the problem, even when you know the problem exists. One of the most avid users of Global Forest Watch is actually the government of Peru. There are certain agencies that are tasked with monitoring and supervising forests, and they've actually made jokes to us that are not actually that funny, that Global Forest Watch tells them where not to go, because if they go and try to police those areas where they know there are threats, there will be threats made against their lives. So until we can start tackling some of these more systemic governance issues, simply knowing where deforestation is happening is not always enough to address the problem. So I think more investment in trying to tackle some of the bigger corruption problems will be needed in addition to quick technology fixes.
Topher?
I think on top of that, so governance is obviously very important. And we've been actually quite fortunate to be working in mostly partnerships that don't involve official governments in a lot of ways. So we don't work with governments except for one potential project very soon. Most of the times we work with NGOs on the ground, local communities, tribes, who do have their own systems of governance, but these places are outside the sort of interest, outside the boundaries of interest for local governments. And so they have to take it upon themselves to fight against what is often sort of large-scale black market illegal logging or deforestation. But it turns out that with, they want to do this, they just feel a little bit powerless. Just getting them alerts or data is usually not enough. They have to know that they're going to be backed up at various levels. And that's where transparency becomes super important. But allowing them to know that what they're doing and what they're doing is of interest and of note to people around the world does help a lot. So one of the biggest issues is making sure people don't feel alone in their sort of reactions, and making sure the technology is actually about connecting people. Even if in this case we're saying it's about connecting people to the forest, the impetus for them really getting out there to stop it is personal, but it also comes from knowing that they're going to both be recognized for it and, to a certain extent, protected sometimes. But it's a challenge, you know. There's a lot of mismatching when it comes to resources and power on both sides of the table. And in many cases, just letting people there know that where it's happening is not enough. There has to be data that can be then passed on. And transparency has no particular limits. So even if there's no government coverage in an area and the people there can't respond, sometimes it's about then being able to pass the same data on to governments. And we've also found that if local communities start taking responsibility for law and order, then the local governments do want to get involved. I call that the Batman effect, but I'm not sure about that. The other thing when it comes to the challenges are putting sort of what we consider to be high tech in the hands of people out there in the field. Oftentimes that takes a lot of learning curve. That is not the case with cell phones. Everyone knows how to use cell phones and smartphones out there. It's just one of those things that caught on. I don't know how that happened, but everyone gets it. The networks aren't great. You have to find ways around that. But these are tools that people just get. And that's why, but when they think of technology, they think of laptops. So they want to say, I want a laptop. But the truth is that you don't really need a laptop to get anything done anymore. Everyone wants to be, like the modern world. But the truth is that you can accomplish everything you need with a cell phone, and just sort of getting that out there to people is kind of important. I go on this all day, but yeah.
So Virgil, what about you? So I mean, when you get this, when you have use this radar data and it comes back in, and there's someone out there who's doing illegal activities. What do you do? Like, what happens to that data? Who uses that?
Right. So that's, a key to technology success is accounting for the human factor from the beginning, because it should be to help all, to help humans, to help the planet. And in terms of enforcement, there is the incentive problem that in some places the enforcement, perhaps they are the people doing some of the phishing. Again, in terms of transparency, we think the Marine Monitor system, because it's both a local and a cloud system, provides some of that transparency that everyone can see what's happening and not be excluded. But one of the things we're finding as we design our system and our software is the importance to engage on the local level to make sure we're providing a tool that really addresses that local need. And, incentives matter. So, the negative perception perhaps of this radar as well, it's tattletaling on my friends who are doing illegal fishing, but can this radar also provide safety to these boaters in bad weather or other circumstances? Are there other tangible benefits to a community, to our technologies, that again make it easier to adopt and really see that? It's very easy, I think, for us as technologists to see sort of this long-term abstract, if we do this in 30 years and 50 years, look at this major impact. But, you know, at that local level, at the subsistence level, the things we need, they need to have a tangible impact almost immediately in some meaningful way, or it's very hard to get the buy-in we need.
So, Crystal, it seems like a key enabling condition for you would be data availability. So, I mean, you talked about that a little bit, but can you expand on that a little bit more? I mean, it seems like you're really dependent on this satellite data.
Sure. Right now, most of our systems really rely heavily on U.S. government satellite data. So that's the Landsat satellite. And we're actually quite nervous at the moment because under the Trump administration, they're discussing putting a paywall back up on Landsat, which means we would have to start paying again to access this data. And that would be absolutely devastating for the type of monitoring we do because we're processing thousands and thousands of images on a daily basis. So it would be cost prohibitive to have to purchase those. That said, there are new sources of imagery coming online that are freely available. For example, the Europeans have created the Sentinel program, which sort of mirrors Landsat, and that's free. But we also see a backlog in terms of scientists who have the resources and ability to take this data and turn it into information that's useful for the rest of us, because most of us have no idea what to do with a satellite image. So I think it's going to be really important here in the U.S. to try to push really hard on continued open data and transparency. It was a big priority under the previous administration, but I think we need to continue to push for it under this new administration.
Thanks, Crystal. As you develop these technologies, you sort of probably start out with you're trying to solve a problem, but it seems like with Topher, you know, you start out by sort of having this alert system looking for, illegal logging, shotguns, things like that. But it seems like you've kind of gone a different direction. So I'd love to hear a little bit about sort of your, your nimble design, strategy and so how you can adapt to as you find other applications.
Oh yeah, well, it's somewhat opportunistic. To a certain degree, we were trying to find places where we were lucky that it worked pretty early on for being able to detect chainsaws. We saw some success there that made us feel like it was going to be effective. And then there was enough attention around that people came to us and said, "We want to put this out there." So then we had the opportunity to go put it out in half a dozen different places where it barely worked at all. And we had to go out there in the field and find out why you just can't stream data out of the middle of the rainforest, And we had to adapt our technology to make that work. Surprise, surprise. And that was actually a big learning experience because in the process, we found out that, the truth is that if you can catch loggers, if you have a system that's there to catch loggers, hopefully it's not going to catch any loggers like 99.9% of the time. But the rainforest is super noisy, super full of all these amazing insights. And if we're building a system that can send all this stuff up to the cloud, man, like what an opportunity to build something for scientists and ecologists and the rest, and in the process make a bigger case for helping protect the places in general. And since we did make the choice that instead of doing it on the phone itself or on these devices in the field, that we were going to stream it up to the cloud and do the processing there, then it became possible for us to really extend the detection, but also the ways in which we made use of that. So, I mean, nothing. I think that at the end of the day, we have to make what's happening in the forest valuable to not just the people there, but to the rest of the world. And so one of the ways in which we sort of like try and prove that concept is say, if we're streaming data up to the cloud to analyze it, we can also, make an app that'll stream like the live sounds from the rainforest. So this is Brazil, like right now, from really just a piece of trash, like an old cell phone that's literally 9 years old, that's been sitting up in a tree for 14 months. And it's still doing this like hard work and all the time. And does this have value? Like I don't know, but I do feel like there's an opportunity for us to take that data and get people interested in it, and that has value to people on the ground as well. I think that a lot of times when it comes to technology, we focus on the super high tech stuff, like how do you build the coolest device, or how do you come up with the coolest way to analyze it, but those who focus on all the pipes in between can really make something that's extensible and make a big difference. So in our case, we didn't want people to have to go out and collect SD cards from devices in the forest. We wanted to have that stuff come out automatically. And that was really helpful for us because now we can build something that can work in many ways. And I feel like Global Forest Watch is the same sort of idea.
Yeah, just building on that a little bit. I mean, are there surprising ways that your technologies are being used? So Crystal and Virgil, like, you built something for a certain purpose, but now it's being used for something totally different.
Absolutely. And I think we tried to keep that in mind when we created Global Forest Watch, that We knew we had something very powerful, but we couldn't possibly anticipate all the interesting ways that it could be used. And that's why we tried to be very sort of open with our data and technology. Everything's open source. We tried to make it, you know, freely available and easily accessible. And as a result, we hear stories coming out of the woodwork about people using our data in ways that we never could have imagined. We heard in Mexico that law enforcement was using Global Forest Watch to identify illicit drugs, because often you would see forest being cleared before the coca would go in. So I never would have imagined it being used for drug enforcement, but apparently that use case was out there.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
I think just to add, one of the challenges for us is to be able to harvest all of these stories, because we're putting it out there for free. You can register on the website, but you don't have to. So often when I'm hearing these stories, it's because I happen to be at a conference and someone comes up to me and said, hey, I love Global Forest Watch, I'm doing XYZ. But I imagine that there are many more thousands of stories out there that I haven't even heard yet.
I use it like every day.
And we use it all the time too.
Yeah, one of the things that actually surprised us in our marine mapping project is we really envisioned it as a boater fisherman resource to see all the rules in one place. And then via our NOAA partnership, we expanded beyond MPAs, because in the process of mapping the marine protected areas, we came across a lot of just fisheries regulation. And we said, well, that has restrictions. They're less restrictive, but let's include that as well. So let's map those. And what we find out is actually within the government now, we've been told that our map was the first place even the people creating these regulations in government had ever seen everything together in one place, and that they're heavily using it now as a resource in trying to formulate the future plans for regulation. So again, we thought we were really building something for boaters and fishermen, but it turns out we're also building it in a way for the people who created those regulations in the first place.
So Crystal, you talked about people coming up to you and giving you examples of how Global Forest Watch is being used. But I mean, to all the panelists, how do you track the impact of your innovations and, you know, understand what's working and what's not working?
It's really difficult to track the impact, especially when you're doing something at a global scale like we are. We have sort of two different approaches, and there's a big missing middle in between them. So on one hand, we can look at the analytics of the website, and I can give you a lot of cool statistics about how many people are using Global Forest Watch from which countries and which cities, and maybe use something about their IP address to see if they're from government or academia. And on the other hand, we have a network of partners around the world who are giving us these incredibly rich stories about exactly how they're using the data and the types of impacts it's having forcing people on the ground. But I have a sense that there is a big chunk of stories in the middle that's not being captured either by the analytics or by that small subset of stories we're hearing from our partners. And we're trying to think of creative ways of pulling those stories out of our user base, creating sort of contests or incentives, because we can share your stories on our website. But it's challenging, and we're certainly open to any creative ideas you might have.
Yeah. Go ahead, Virgil.
A big success story on our whale alert effort is it was adopted by the National Park Service in Glacier Bay as a pilot program last summer, is the official mechanism for the cruise ship industry to submit whale sightings to the Park Service, and then for the Park Service to get information back to every cruise ship captain. So again, they'd know where the hot spots were to make sure they were going slow, not hit whales. Previously, they were doing weekly updates on paper, on PDF files. And this let it get it directly in a mobile app with a live map that showed their own position relative to the whale sightings. That was successful enough that it became essentially the permanent program this summer in the Bay, and it's now being looked at by Department of Fisheries Canada in response to the right whale situation this summer. And, you know, it's exciting to see that technology take root and have an impact. But overall, it definitely is a challenge in general just to tease out all the different ways it might be used.
So conservation has sort of a notoriously bad reputation for lack of collaboration. And it seems like all of you guys are building tools that are sort of organization agnostic that can be used by anyone. So, I mean, how do you build collaboration and get people to use these applications?
So that's really important to us because there's so many things out there that have already been built so well. And there's so many people who can build certain aspects of things better than us. So we're always trying to look at what we're doing that's unique and then try to not just take advantage of the things that are already out there, whether it be open source software or just the infrastructure in the form of a cell phone network. Or in other cases, it's like, do we want to build our own piece of hardware or do we want to use the old cell phones that have already been made 100 million of them? So that's one example of like use what's already there. For us, that's important. But between conservation groups as well, everyone wants to build a whole system, and we just have to a certain degree, I think, look around and not just respect what other people are doing, but actually make use of it. And that's going to require us sometimes to let go of the things we love the most. So we're always trying to look for ways to do that. We want to build systems that allow, even if it's not about pulling the sound out of the forest, maybe if there's a camera trap near where our system is, it can send data up to the cloud through the networks that we're creating. That's really an ongoing question for us. Anyone who wants to work with each other, I would love to feed our data into Global Forest Watch because there's no way that we could ever possibly have the same level of reach that they do. One issue is that Global Forest Watch covers literally the entire globe. We cover at the moment, a dozen different areas on the ground. So, the places where you can hear the sound coming from, are few and far between compared to this comprehensive data set. But I think that taking these steps forward in all these different ways is important. And recognizing the strengths of other people's technology is great, too.
Yeah, collaboration is really critical to everything that Global Forest Watch does. I work for an organization called the World Resources Institute, and Global Forest Watch is an initiative that lives within WRI. But in order to make Global Forest Watch possible, it's really a partnership of technology companies like Google, universities like University of Maryland, grassroots organizations, companies. I mean, really an incredible spectrum of organizations and companies that are participating in this work and contributing in some way. And we've been very careful to make the initiative feel owned by this entire partnership and to make sure that all partners are getting credit for the incredible work that they're doing. But I think I think our vision for how Global Forest Watch goes to scale is really about getting partners to collaborate with each other and not just collaborate through WRI. And that is something that is easier said than done. And we're still looking for ways to sort of build that network and build that collaborative spirit within the partnership because we have limited capacity at WRI to facilitate all of those relationships. I do think we still face a lot of challenges with unfortunate competition in our field, right? Because we're all working towards the same cause, but we compete for funding. We compete for notoriety for our work because that helps us get more funding. And there, in terms of a lot of the data we work with, there are entire careers that are built around single data sets, and those data sets are often very expensive to build. So it can be a lot of work convincing organizations and people, individuals, that they should share openly and work with each other. But I think once we see more of that happening, we actually start to see so many benefits from that. So I think there's often for us a little hurdle in trying to get people to be willing to share. Once they do, a lot of the fears that they had about what would happen if they started sharing their information and their work start to fall away, and then others are convinced to come on board as well. So I think we just need to keep sort of pushing for it and see if we can get enough momentum built.
Yeah, and I'll just to talk a second on the more the technology side of the equation is, we really try hard in our projects to design around openness. So using data formats that are standardized, that are easy to share, designing around application programming interfaces or standardized methods so that if someone else's computer system wants to talk to ours, it's easy rather than hard. And when we source data, trying to make sure the data we source as much as possible is not encumbered by restrictive rights. Because, again, if we can be as open as possible about the data we share, hopefully that gets reciprocated in turn.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Can Technology Drive Conservation and Create Healthy and Safe Environments? With Brett Butler, founder and CEO of Manga Bay, Tropa White, founder and CEO of Rainforest Connection, Crystal Davis, Director, Global Forest Watch, and Virgil Zitterlund, Director of Protected Seas. You know, as I listen to what our panel has shared to you with us, I'd like to share something with you that I had completely forgotten. I had actually the opportunity to go to a remote area where there were whales, and it brings it back for me because one of the things that had happened in that area, it was a very poor area and very remote, and somehow they had connected with people in the United States. They had a school, and the people they connected with were able to send them their laptops and things like that, and they could actually connect with the school that had sent them the information. And they were out in a very remote area. So they were not only learning from their laptops and what they were learning, but they were learning English, and they were learning more and more about their native languages. So what you're doing, I hope you will keep doing, because you never know. I never would have known had I not just happened to be there, that such wonderful things can happen with technology worldwide. So having said that, now it's time for our audience questions, and we have a lot of good questions. So, Red, I'm back to you.
Thank you, Ann. Yeah, so we've got a lot of great questions here from the audience. So this one question I pulled out is about funding. So it's actually directed to Crystal, but I think it actually applies to everyone here. So the question is, how did Global Forest Watch get its funding for its platform? And does the source of funding create any bias towards who can access that platform or how they can use it? But again, I think that applies to everyone up here. So, Chris, we'll start with you, but get into the other folks.
Sure. Our first major donor was actually the government of Norway. But we also have other government funding from the UK and from USAID, as well as some foundation funding. And increasingly, we're seeing some financial support from companies who have been using our data to gather information about where they are facing deforestation risk in their agricultural supply chains. We're very determined to make sure our information remains objective and independent and is always seen as such by our users, so our sources of funding never influence what our data says or how we communicate about our data. I think the biggest challenge for us going forward is that data continues to be expensive, even though a lot of these algorithms are automated and, for the time being, the satellite imagery is freely available. Being able to continue to maintain these algorithms and run them, get the information out in formats that people can easily access and understand, is quite expensive over the long term. So we really do need to start thinking about the sustainability of these monitoring systems that we're building, and we don't have all the solutions yet. And one of the approaches we're thinking about looking at is, now that we are starting to build more of a corporate audience for this information and are starting to build tools that are specifically designed for the private sector, can we start charging for some of those private sector apps and using some of that money to feed into maintaining these monitoring systems over the long term? But that's still an area yet to be explored for us.
Tofer, you want to take it?
Yeah, so our first funding came from Kickstarter campaign, which was pretty cool. But it wasn't a type of situation where people just gave money because they wanted to save the rainforest, I don't think. I think it was because we continue to do this as well. We really do think it's important to make what we're doing into a personal experience for people. So that's where like this app comes from, so you can listen to the forest, so you can get alerts about things you care about. And like, even the story you were telling before, like, that's a perfect example of the fact that you went somewhere, you saw something in conservation, you cared about it, and it became a story of yours, and you wanted to share that with us. The only way that we can make a huge effect in conservation is if conservation becomes everybody's personal, not necessarily full-on mission, but everyone's personal something they're proud of, something they're proud to support and share. And you can sort of put that more crudely and say that we have to be giving people something in exchange for their support of it. But you can also think of it as just sort of making what's happening in these faraway places about people here. And the truth is that I think that actually is one of the biggest solutions out there. If we can get, the truth is that what we pay attention to, that is what the rest of the world cares about. And so if we can make what's happening out there interesting and accessible to people through products, then that really helps us to fund it. And so at the moment, we started with Kickstarter. We're now mostly grant funded, but we hope to get back to this model where we are providing people access to what's happening around the world in a way that they care about and are interested in, not because they feel guilty, but because they're getting something out of it. And that's what we would like to – that's what we think the future of conservation is based on that.
Virgil?
Yeah. At Protect the Seas, we're fortunate to have received stable funding through private donations that allow us to carry on our core development work. With the Marine Monitor System, there's a fair bit of hardware cost involved with each of those systems, and we've received some very generous donations from conservation groups to be able to allow us to locate those at different key places, both here in California and around the world. The Whale Alert application is primarily funded through the National Marine Sanctuary Foundation and the International Fund for Animal Welfare. Also, the interesting thing with that is a number of the commercial shipping companies have also made donations, essentially to show their desire to be proactive in reducing ship strikes and not reactive.
Yeah. Cool, great. We've got a ton of good questions here. I'm sure we're going to get all of them, but do my best here. So this is a good follow-up question. So for all the panelists, if money were no issue, what cutting-edge technology would most help you achieve your goal?
You want me to start?
Sure.
If I had a major, $10 million grant at my disposal tomorrow, I actually wouldn't put it into the technology. I would put it into figuring out how to get people to use the technology better and for good. I think that's the bigger limiting factor right now. Not to say there's not a lot of really cool tech projects I could think of as well.
Virgil?
So I would say ubiquitous, low-cost, high-speed global internet is probably the biggest issue facing the ocean. We've got a lot of cool sensor technology getting miniaturized, being able to run longer and longer on less power or through novel power systems. But underlying all of that is the need to have access to the data quickly and cheaply, and that's just not something that's easily, really readily done at all on the oceans today.
Seconded on that one, definitely.
Great.
And, we're trying to accomplish it, but oceans are even harder.
So since this is a technology session, I have some technical questions for Topher here. So one is, how do you recharge the batteries in cell phones? Another is whether you've had to deal with sabotage of equipment. Mm. And then another one is, what is your equipment mean time between failure in that environment? And how do you harden your phones so they survive in the rainforest?
Yeah, the motif of all those is that the rainforest is a pretty hellish place to put a piece of technology. So is space, I guess, when it comes to satellites. But I tend to think of them the same way.
We don't have to do that part.
Oceans are hard too. In our case, we have the phones or the actual sensors. They go in boxes to protect them. They're solar panels that we had to build to work under a tree canopy, which is a really bad place to try and generate solar power. We've also chosen a pretty difficult way to deal with that, which is to try and transmit all the data 24/7 up into the cloud, which takes a lot more power than just processing it on the device itself. So that was those were hard design choices that took us some time to get there. But over time, we've gotten to the point, and I actually feel good about the choices we made. So we have these special solar panels that we built to work under tree canopy. We're hoping to abandon those altogether in favor of ones that people can put together from solar panels that are lying around in these countries. Was there another part of that question as well?
Meantime till failure.
So the one we put out there that are based on these sort of trashed old cell phones, they usually last over a year, and the longest ones have lasted over 18 months. But we expect we have a whole new version of this we're putting out there. We expect that they will last for years. And that's pretty impressive when you think these things are working really hard. They're streaming data 24/7. I don't know how they do it, but, The technology that's being built by some of these companies, whether it be old cell phones or some of these sort of embedded computers, it's really amazing stuff. And we got to piggyback on that. So, yeah. And it's helpful because imagine all the data that's there. Everything that's out there. These things are working hard for years. I feel like they're satellites up there. We put them up there. We hope we don't have to get them for years. But all of that's like an arc. It's almost like an audio arc of what's happening in the forest. We're going to be able to learn so much over time. Even if we can't catch it right now, we'll be able to go back and look at it for future passes.
So, Crystal, you're putting your $10 million into getting more people to use Global Forest Watch. How do you currently go about spreading the word about Global Forest Watch?
We rely a lot on our partner network. So we work with organizations, large organizations like WWF, to small grassroots organizations through a small grants program that we have. And we've created communication networks through our partners when we launched. So, for example, this week we launched our first mobile app, which will allow people to access GFW alerts on their phones and then navigate to those alerts offline, document what they're seeing. So we're really trying to push that out through our partner networks to get the word out. That said, I'm constantly disappointed when I meet people who are working in this field and never heard of Global Forest Watching and would benefit greatly from it. So, again, always looking for more opportunities to get the word out what we're doing.
But then they know. Then they know because you told them.
Yeah. And what about you, Virgil? How do you get word out about your various applications?
For our marine radar, for Marine Monitor, it is a lot of working with our partner NGOs that have local presence, especially in the island nations and coastal areas. Here in the United States, working through the National Marine Sanctuaries, who are often the ones on the front lines of protecting the U.S. Marine Protected Areas. It's the internet age, so Facebook page, going to conferences, trying to do media events like this great opportunity here. But that's always, as a technologist, I tend to want to be heads down in the technology, but none of these solutions, like I said, get adopted without external effort. And it's really important that we pay attention to that.
Mm-hmm. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Unfortunately, we've come to that part of our program, which is the last question. So here is the last question, and I am very impressed with all of the information and what you've shared with us today. So this is the question of the day.
Oh, no pressure. I'm missing so many good questions here. So I guess I'll bring it back to the people in the room here, really. And I guess how can people in Silicon Valley help or get involved with your work?
I think for us, it all comes back to almost to answer the last question as well. How do we get the word out? We try and find ways to make what we're doing about everybody who uses it and not just about what we're focused on. For the same reason that then if you're listening to this and you hear some crazy bird, it sounds like a laser fight in the forest, like a Star Wars laser fight. That's cool. That's something you remember and it becomes about you and you want to share it. That's what we want to do. So there's no place in the world that has mastered sort of human psychology when it comes to usability and stickiness and how to get something to be so important that you have to come back to it as Silicon Valley. So we want people to help test us, test what we're doing, to help us develop it, to come up with ideas for how we can make the rainforest about everybody around the world and not just about the rainforest.
There's a lot, but if I could just pick one thing, I think there's actually a lot that Silicon Valley can teach organizations like my own about how to be innovative. We like to say that we're innovative, but since I started working on Global Forest Watch, terms like, agile development, I didn't even know what that meant. And we're not very agile in the conservation community. Part of that's linked to our funding models. But I would love to work more in partnership with companies, startups, other organizations in Silicon Valley, and learn how to be more agile in the types of approaches we're taking and learn how to adopt the technologies that you're developing, maybe not for conservation, but maybe could have a great application for conservation. So I think we just need to talk more and work together more.
Yeah, and I think, Red, I think you started off with a great theme for tonight of technology as a ray of hope for conservation. And, we've seen the amazing things, the transformative things that have come out of Silicon Valley, and that comes from the people here and the people, the diversity. So find a great project. A lot of great things here in Silicon Valley came out of garages done at nights and weekends. There's very interesting work in artificial intelligence, in big data processing, in robust networks in tough places, all these things we've talked about. So we definitely encourage for the technologists in the audience, we invite you to sort of join with us and let's solve some big problems.
Yeah. I feel like there's also a mantra in Silicon Valley that to be successful, you should solve a problem that you have. And that's why we have great ways to cut the taxi wait time from like 5 minutes to 2 minutes, which is a really hard problem. But it's really satisfying to solve someone else's problem on the other side of the world, which might be a simpler problem to solve from a technology standpoint. And I think people here would like to do that. So that's another call to action, I'd say.
Well, thank you very much. This was a great panel. So thanks for participating.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rhett.
Thanks, Rhett.
Rhett's the best, by the way.
As I mentioned before, this is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Program. And you know what happens when you're Chair of the Environment Program is you really get to ask the very last question. So this is for each of our panelists. And I'm very curious, how did each of you decide this is what you wanted your life work to be? So we'll start with Rhett because he's been our moderator and we haven't heard him tell us a lot about his work and what he does. And how did you decide to do it?
Well, it happened kind of accidentally. It was a little bit of a night and weekend sort of thing, but it really began when I was young. I had the opportunity to travel thanks to having a mother who was a travel agent, and I really liked frogs, and the best frogs are in the rainforest. So I went to rainforests, and then I learned what was happening to them and had a personal experience where a forest was destroyed and decided I wanted to make a difference and raise awareness. So I wrote a book about rainforests and then converted it into a website so people could read it for free. And then I decided to quit my real job and pursue my passion. So that's the story.
Topher White, how about you? What did you want?
Yeah, for me, it's just so satisfying to see something you build be used by people. It's going to be a long road towards us to seeing that be truly impactful. But for me, I wanted to have an impact on climate change. I thought the way to do that was to work on energy, kind of like the way we all sort of think that's the case. But the second largest contributor to climate change is deforestation. So I thought I was building something just to help this Gibbon Reserve in Sumatra, and then suddenly realized that it could be useful on a much wider scale. And that's a pretty addictive thing to figure out. To figure out what you're building can be really impactful, it's hard to turn away from it.
So I'm wondering, how old were you when you decided all of that?
I was 31 when I decided.
Wow, that's amazing. It really is that you saw that then. Yeah, that's really great.
Well, we still have to make an impact.
Crystal, how about you?
Yeah,
this is Crystal Davis we're listening to.
I think my answer will really affirm a lot of what Topher has been saying tonight, because I think the future of conservation, the success of conservation is really about getting people to care on some personal level, and then a lot of that starts at a very young age. So for me, it was reading one of Jane Goodall's books when I think I was probably 8 that wasn't a heavy scientific textbook about chimpanzees, but allowed me to relate to chimpanzees on a more human level. And ever since that age, I've been obsessed with the idea of being able to save some of these critical species. And as I got to learn more about what it was going to take to do that, my education and career went in different directions. But I've been committed to this cause from a really early age.
Virgil Sitterlin?
So my love of conservation really started in high school. I grew up in rural Ohio, and our high school had a very unique teacher who had actually conservation as a science elective, a two-year science elective. And so that really started to grow my desire at that time, mostly land conservation. But my first job in the Air Force took me to coastal Florida, where I fell in love with the ocean, which led me to form a startup in marine navigation, which led me to start working on the Whale Alert Project and joining Protected Seas. And quite honestly, once you've worked with ocean people, I think, it's hard to really imagine working with anybody else, at least for me personally, that, you know, some of the most fun I've ever, you know, that I have is, you know, field work out in with, you know, doing ocean science, talking about the ocean with people and experiencing it.
Forest people are really boring.
and I'll share with you, for me, this goes way back when I graduated from college and I wanted a job. And there were two things that I was doing in my life. I had come out of the civil rights movement, so you know how long ago that was. And at the time, the war on poverty was beginning, and all you had to do was have a degree, breathe, take a test, and get assigned. And there I found myself roaming the agricultural and communities all the way from Salinas Gilroy up to the Oregon border and the Native Americans and San Francisco and Oakland with the war on poverty, trying to figure out how to teach people literacy and get them jobs and things like that. And the biggest impact on me was actually all of those communities, because somewhere in that, without even probably knowing the word environmental, it did come to me that a healthy, safe environment was an environmental right. It was a right that all of us had. And that stayed with me all these years, and that's what changed me, because I had never seen so much poverty and so many children up and down the state that were involved in the poverty. So I think we all had something behind us that struck each of us very deeply at one point. And I really appreciate all that you have shared with us tonight. It's been a really wonderful discussion. So again, we are at a point where we are really ending our program tonight. And I want to thank all of our people here tonight. Rhett Butler, who is our founder and CEO of Mongo Bebe. Troper White, founder and CEO of Rainforest Connection. Crystal Davis, Director, Global Forest Watch. Virgil Zitterlin, Director of Protected Seas, Chief Technology Officer. So let's give them a real big hand of applause for all their work. And my thanks and all our thanks to our terrific audience here. What a great audience we've had. You can find our programs at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on commonwealthclub.org also for multimedia access, watch, listen to programs, current news feeds, streaming audio, radio schedules, and 230 radio and video radio stations on national radio networks. Also find audio and videotapes and free weekly podcasts and archive programs. Look for our coming fall environmental programs. On Thursday, October 12th, will be Tom Steemstra. And he, as you know, is an Emmy Award winner. And I think probably most of you, having lived in the Bay Area, have heard Tom and listened to him on the radio. His program is going to be The Importance of Catch and Release for Hunting, Fishing, and the Environment. Wednesday, October 26th, come and join us, the Sierra Club, at 125 years, from Yosemite to climate change, with Bruce Hamilton, Deputy Executive Director of the Sierra Club. And Wednesday, November 8th, Climate Game Changer, how San Francisco, the city and county's compost plan can heal the planet, from our experts at the San Francisco Department of the Environment. Now, Tuesday, November 14th, and I bet you want to come, we always have a holiday toast to the wine harvest. This will be the 2017 wine harvest. We will have a panel of wine experts, and we will have holiday wine tasting after the program. Tuesday, November 28th, The Nature of Change, The Ecological Journey of the Presidio. Join the Presidio San Francisco's ecologists and the transformation from an army post to an amazing ecological and an environmental national park. Please come and share this, the wonderful place that we have right here in our own community. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Join us in October at our new Commonwealth Club. Remember, as of October 1st, we will be at 110 Embarcadero. So don't look for us here. Look for us where? 110 Embarcadero. So again, our thanks to you, and we really want you to come and join us, and we can see our new location. I think you'll like it a lot. And this meeting, by the way, is of the Commonwealth Club of California, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.